Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois.
Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Daniel Pink. He's the author of a book that has influenced a lot of people, got people excited. It's certainly been very popular. It's a book that's titled A Whole New Mind. The subtitle is Why Right-Brainers Will Rule the Future. It's now available in paperback, published by Riverhead Books. It has sold well. It's now in its eighth North American printing, and it's being translated into a number of other languages. And I think to introduce the subject, I can do no better than just read you a few lines from the introduction of the book. Here's what he writes. He says, "The last few decades have belonged to a certain kind of person with a certain kind of mind. Computer programmers who could crank code, lawyers who could craft contracts, MBAs who could crunch numbers. But," he says, "things are changing. The future belongs to a very different kind of person with a different kind of mind. Creators and empathizers, pattern recognizers, and meaning makers. These people, artists, inventors, designers, storytellers, caregivers, consolers, big picture thinkers, will now reap society's richest rewards and share its greatest joys." We'll talk a little bit about some of the ideas that you can find this morning in the book, A Whole New Mind, with Dan Pink. And of course, questions are welcome from people who are listening. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Our guest is a contributing editor at Wired. His articles on business and technology have appeared in New York Times, Harvard Business Review, Fast Company, and other publications. He does a lot of speaking on this very subject. His last real job, as it says in his official bio, was working in the White House. He served between 1995 and 1997 as chief speechwriter to Vice President Al Gore. He also worked as an aide to the U.S. Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, and also an economic policy staffer in the U.S. Senate. He is a graduate of Northwestern University and also of the Yale Law School, and he makes his home in Washington, D.C., and he's joining us by telephone. Mr. Pink, hello.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me on the program.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. Maybe also I should mention, too, that our guest will be here on the campus of the University of Illinois tomorrow. He'll be giving a talk for the Art and Design Futures series. That's in room 100 of Gregory Hall. And I am assuming that anybody interested should feel welcome to stop by and hear what you have to say.
That's right, at 4:30 in the afternoon.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Just to start out, I guess I'm interested in hearing just how wedded you are to this notion of right-brainers and left-brainers as a fact on the ground, so to speak, neuronally speaking, or whether you think that that is more of a metaphor.
I'm using it as a metaphor, really, for the sorts of abilities that are going to become necessary, that are already necessary in the economy that's emerging all around us. Left-brain, right-brain is actually one of those things that where the popularization of the idea has outpaced the science behind it. That is, we got ahead of the science a little bit. But now, actually, thanks to functional magnetic resonance imaging, a lot of the science has caught up. And what we know is that our brains are unbelievably complex. We barely understand how they work. But we do know there's this very elegant, efficient division of labor between the two sides of our brain. The left side of the brain, the left hemisphere, deals with processing that is logical, linear, sequential, rule-based, analytical. That's the side that took the SAT. The right hemisphere of the brain deals with, it's not better or worse, it just has a different set of specialties. It is more, arguably, more artistic, more empathic, more about the big picture rather than the details, more about context rather than text, processes simultaneously rather than sequentially. It deals with synthesis rather than analysis. And I found that metaphor is very clarifying in what's going on in the economy. And the gist of it is this, that it used to be that the abilities that got you ahead in work or in school, particularly in work, were characteristic of the left hemisphere, the logical, linear, SAT spreadsheet kind of abilities. And my argument is that those abilities are absolutely 100% necessary, but no longer enough, and that the scales have tilted so that these abilities more characteristic of the right hemisphere, artistry, empathy, inventiveness, big picture thinking, are increasingly the first among equals. Increasingly, mastery of these abilities are the ones that that marks the fault line between who moves forward and who falls behind.
Mm-hmm. Well, setting aside the discussion about brain structure, which may be in another program, and also knowing that we would be likely to get some argument from people who would say that they felt that, as far as they were concerned, that they were that they somehow integrated these things into one, that they did not feel that they were either one or the other, that they felt that they were sort of a blending of both. And I suppose some people would argue that if you look at those people who were great innovators, great inventors, great artists perhaps, that a lot of those people, they weren't clearly one or the other. They had some qualities of both. I mean, so we set that one aside, too.
Oh, but I actually agree with that. I actually agree with that. I mean, we're talking here about a whole new mind. We're talking, I'm not saying, yeah, absolutely. If somebody with only these right brain abilities without the left brain abilities is a goner. What really matters is having both sets of abilities. But I think increasingly, because of a set of economic forces that we can get to later, I guess, the right brain abilities are essentially the first among equals. And the left brain abilities have become necessary, absolutely 100% necessary, but no longer sufficient.
Well, then maybe let me ask you the question then to talk a little bit about what has changed and how is it you're making this argument that we are making a shift from a one kind of economy and by implication one kind of society to another. What is it that's pushing us in that direction?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a key question, obviously, and the truth of it is that if I had to self-identify, I would actually identify with the left brain side. I'm a very analytical, number-based, sequential kind of guy, and what I did over the last couple of years was really look hard at the evidence, look hard at the data of what's going on in individual careers, what's going on inside organizations, and if you look at the data, the evidence, the facts, in a very hard-headed left brain cause and effect way, to me it seems like there are three big forces that are tilting the scales, again, making these left brain abilities necessary but not sufficient, and the right brain abilities the most important. And they are, I call them abundance, Asia, and automation. Abundance, Asia, automation are the three big forces that are tilting the scales. And by abundance, I mean that we have in this country just an incredible standard of living among middle-class people. We have a problem in this country with poverty, no doubt. That's disgraceful on its own terms. It's doubly disgraceful because of how well the rest of the country is doing. In this country, you have, for instance, more automobiles than you have licensed drivers. You have a material standard of living in this country for middle-class families that is really breathtaking by historic standards and international standards. And that tilts the scales in two ways. First, in a business sense, it means that we have so many choices in a marketplace that if you're in business selling anything, essentially, a product, a service, an experience, the functional side of it, the logical left-brain side of a product, a service, an experience, only gets you to the table. The way you distinguish yourself in a crowded marketplace is through these more right-brain things, aesthetics, spirituality, emotion. This is why we have this explains why Target is such a force. This explains why you can go and buy a designer toilet brush, a designer fly swatter. That is, in a world where functionality has been satisfied and oversatisfied, these non-functional, aesthetic, emotional kinds of features really matter. The second reason that abundance tilts the scales is that all of this prosperity has not made us any happier. We've gotten three times richer over the last 5 years per capita, but if you look at the survey data on levels of satisfaction or subjective well-being, we haven't gotten any happier. We've gotten three times richer, but not one jot happier. And I think what that has done is prosperity has liberated us to pursue. It hasn't fulfilled us, but it's liberated us so that we can pursue meaning and purpose and transcendence at a scale that is really unprecedented. This is why you have this widespread search for meaning. This is why you have 15 million Americans doing yoga, 10 million Americans meditating. It's why Oprah is such a force because she's about leading your best life. This is why Purpose-Driven Life is one of the best-selling nonfiction books of all time. This is why these things that were once reserved for the very well-off have been democratized. So that's abundance. Asia tilts the scales because A lot of the work, a lot of the routine left brain, white collar work, basic accounting, basic legal research can get done cheaper overseas. And so when that happens, then people in North America, Western Europe, and Japan have to do stuff that folks overseas can't do cheaper. And that tends to be not the routine left brain work, but more of the less routine artistic empathic right brain work. And finally, we have automation. Again, it's the same thing that happened in the industrial economy. Machines last century replaced or at least augmented the human back, human muscle. This century, you have software that is replacing or at least augmenting the human brain. But the part of the brain that it's augmenting or replacing is not the artistic empathic side, but the logical, linear, rule-based calculation side. So you have accountants who lose work to TurboTax. You have various kinds of online programs where you can get legal forms or you can get a divorce online, threatening certain kinds of lawyers doing routine work. So all of those things together, abundance, Asia, automation, to my mind, are tilting the scales, making the left brain abilities absolutely necessary, but just not enough, and making the right brain abilities the ones that matter most. Mm.
Just for a second to go back to the second thing that you mentioned, the Oprah factor. If you talk about current interest in self-examination, self-improvement, perhaps you'd add fitness and spirituality, mm-hmm. and you know all those kind of things you're talking about, how do you determine whether something like that is a fad or whether it is in fact the beginning of some kind of larger, more stable, more permanent kind of change?
Well, I mean, there's no foolproof way to do it, but one way is to see it moving to the mainstream. Yoga, I think, is a very interesting example. I mean, 20 years ago, yoga, the number of people doing yoga was relatively small. You did not see it in middle-class shopping centers. Today, you've got 15 million Americans doing yoga. You walk, maybe Champaign-Urbana isn't a good example, but you go to Chicago or Kankakee, and you're going to see a middle-class person with a yoga mat in a way that you wouldn't 20 years ago. So you see it in some ways with something even like connected to this in a way, organic food. It used to be that the only place to get organic food was at some kind of campus food co-op. And now you can go to mainstream groceries and get the organic food because people are willing to pay a premium for that level of wellness. So that's one way. Certain things, of course, are fads, but I don't think that the pursuit of wellness, this pursuit of spirituality, the pursuit of meaning, and those things are fads at all. I think they've become part of I think it's a luxury of the incredible progress, economic progress that this country has made, that has been democratized. I mean, you see it in people, anybody who has to hire somebody for a job recognizes that almost everybody coming to work for a job is in some fashion looking for a source of meaning, a source of purpose in a way that just didn't exist, say, when my grandparents were in the workforce and you were still living in the shadow of the Great Depression. You were just simply, that work was simply about getting a paycheck. It wasn't about any notion of purpose. It was about getting money in your pocket, not about finding meaning. And I think now if you talk to people about their work, you see this, you know, widespread pursuit of meaning and purpose in people's work.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Daniel Pink. He is a contributing editor at Wired. His articles on business and technology have appeared in a number of places, including the New York Times and the Harvard Business Review. He is the author of a book that lays out some of these ideas here that he's discussing. It's titled A Whole New Mind, the subtitle Why Right-Brainers Will Rule the Future, and it's published by Riverhead Books. It's in paper. Sold a lot of books already. And questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You have outlined a kind of a progression of different kind of economies based basically on what it is that people do. Mm-hmm. And you're certainly not the first person to identify this at all. It's something that we see when we move from a time starting out where mostly because you needed so many people to produce food, almost everybody was involved in farming. Then as farming becomes more mechanized, you need fewer people. Well, then you see people we move into the industrial age and more people move off the land from rural areas into urban and more people go outside of the home to work and they work in factories. And then from that, we go to the age where we are now, the information age, that kind of economy. And now you're pointing to this next sort of thing that you call the conceptual age. I think part of the problem people point to is that what happens is if we follow this path along, that over time we have fewer and fewer people who are making stuff. Someone's got to make stuff. I mean, physical things. And some people would argue that the problem that we have now with our economy is that someone's still got to make the stuff, and someone does, but they're not. It's not us, that we have outsourced all of this. And I would ask this question, can we really survive as a society if everybody is creators and empathizers and we're relying on somebody else, particularly somebody in the developing world or developing world, to make the stuff that we need? I mean, doesn't still have to have, in a sense, don't we still have to have elements of all these other, and a healthy percentage of elements of these other kinds of economies still going for us?
Yeah, the answer is, I guess, a qualified yes on that. I mean, the pattern that you're identifying is exactly right, that we moved from the agriculture age to the industrial age to the information age to what I call the conceptual age. And in each of those junctures, we had these kinds of questions. When we moved from the agriculture age to the industrial age, there were concerns about, well, the economy is about making stuff for people to eat. We can't have are we going to have enough jobs if people are suddenly making things? Is there going to be enough demand for all of the mass-produced goods? And it turned out, yes, there was. And so the same sort of forces that moved us from the agriculture age to the industrial age to the information age to now the conceptual age are the same. In the agriculture age, we got better at producing food, so we needed fewer people to do it. That's technology. That's basically automation. We were able to import food from other places. That's Asia. That's globalization. And as societies get richer, they desire new things. So we had demands for things beyond food. We wanted goods. And so the same thing happened in the industrial age. We got better at producing goods, so we needed fewer people to do it. We were able to import cheaper goods from overseas. And a rising prosperity created demand for all kinds of things, services, experiences. Same thing with the information age and now into the conceptual age. And each of those junctures, there have been questions. I grew up in Ohio when the Rust Belt was rusting, and we were sort of moving from that information age from the industrial age to the information age. And there were these questions about, well, economies are about making things. We can't have an economy built on services. The service economy is a joke. I remember my own father saying that we can't have an economy built on services. We can't have an economy where everyone is running around giving each other haircuts. But that turned out not to be what a service economy is. It didn't account for search engine optimizers. It didn't account for the web. It didn't account for the rise of nursing. It didn't account for the rise of management consulting. And so I think human ingenuity is essentially boundless, and it's always creating new opportunities and new possibilities. And when we're at a juncture like we are now, people tend to be understandably somewhat fearful, but this has always been the trajectory, and we've always had this capacity to create new jobs and simply get better at things. I mean, take manufacturing, and manufacturing is a great example of this. The United States has the largest manufacturing economy in the world. We just do it with a lot fewer people than we did it with than 30 years ago because we got very good at it. And even the jobs that exist in manufacturing today are less of the routine kind of manufacturing jobs and involve a more sophisticated use of programming computers and operating robots and so forth. So it's the same thing with the information age to the conceptual age. I think that I can't say beyond any doubt that, oh, sure, everything will turn out fine and prosperity will continue to rise. But that's always been the trajectory. And if I were to bet, that's the trajectory I would bet heavily on right now.
I can imagine this book would be popular among people who think of themselves more as right-brainers. And I'd have to say, again, to take acknowledge the fact that partly we're talking about metaphor here, I would have to say I would put myself in that camp. And I can imagine a lot of people like me looking at this book and saying, well, it's about time, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and the computer jockeys have been ruling the world. And it's about time that people like me, who are mathematically and computerly challenged, are going to be coming into our own age. I think to myself, I said this to my wife last night, well, boy, I hope this guy's right, because if he is, then the next age belongs to us. And she sort of said, well, we'll see about that. and I guess that you couldn't go wrong selling a book to an underprivileged population like that, that felt that it was about time that they were on top of things.
Well, I mean, I think that there are some people who have gone and gotten, say, an MFA at the University of Illinois, and whose parents are saying, what are you doing getting an MFA? What are you going to do with that? And it turns out that in many ways, an MFA, a Master's of Fine Art, is in a fine arts degree is in many ways the most valuable kind of business degree, because it's hard to the skills that you learn, the abilities you learn, are hard to outsource and hard to automate. Your point about Steve Jobs and Bill Gates is actually quite interesting, because I actually think there's a distinction between those two. Bill Gates is Mr. IQ, Mr. Left Brain. Steve Jobs is actually a very, very curious entrepreneur. Steve Jobs, when he designed the Macintosh 23 years ago, when the Macintosh came out 22 years ago, he said, I want a computer for right brain people. And that's why it had that great graphical user interface, and that's why it was so easy to use. And even today, Steve Jobs, you know, enormously successful with Pixar and with the iPod, he was traveling in Australia a few months ago, and they asked him, Mr. Jobs, what do you look for when you hire employees at your high-tech company, Apple Computer, your company that's dead center in Silicon Valley? And he said, and these are his words, social skills and a good drawing portfolio. Now, those are very right-brain things. He's not looking for, you know, the great engineer, because the breakthroughs are coming from people who can do things that you can't automate and that you can't outsource and that satisfy these non-material yearnings of a very abundant age.
Well, we have a caller here to bring into the conversation, so let us do that. Someone listening this morning in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll admit up front that I find a lot very appealing in, you know, your analysis, especially being somebody who graduated with the MFA. But, you know, in your economic analysis you're putting forward, I find somewhat problematic, because the reality is that the disparity of wealth is actually growing and has been for some time, and the trajectory is in the wrong direction, where, you know, there's a few people at the very top that are getting wealthier and wealthier in unimaginable ways, while those in the middle are somewhat stagnating or falling behind, and those at the bottom are falling really far behind. And I'm just wondering how you factor that in.
Yeah, I think it's a fair point. There's actually some recent data that's just out, and there's a very interesting column in Fortune magazine. I think it's the current issue that shows that actually that kind of disparity over the last 4 years has actually been reduced. And one explanation for it is the fact that a lot of these white-collar jobs, a lot of these routine white-collar jobs can be outsourced and automated. And that's actually, and a lot of the jobs at the lower end of the wage spectrum, because they require some amount of physical presence, are harder to outsource. Now, we don't know whether that data is going to reflect any kind of broader trend, but it's an interesting development. I mean, what you're making actually, in some ways, a critique that's more important than the set of abilities that are necessary in the world of work. We have an economy that is very much, again, to me, it has little to do with the left brain or right brain or information age or conceptual age, but the way that our economy has worked to this point, it's very much a winner-take-all economy. You have enormous rewards to the people at the very top, and a significant drop-off after that. And that is probably, I agree with you, I think that's actually somewhat dangerous. I think that's dangerous for society. And I think in some ways, if we move to an economy built more on these artistic and empathic skills, these more fundamentally human abilities, then there's a chance, and it's only a chance, I'm not going to be Pollyanna-ish about it, there's a chance that we could return to a greater measure of broadly shared prosperity.
Well, I'd like to hear more about how we make that happen, because I think that, you know, it is, as you say, it's a very dangerous scenario, and it could lead to, I mean, I think things are pretty bad in the world at this point, but it could lead to things being much, much worse.
Perhaps. I mean, I'm not. You mean the move to these more right brain abilities could make things worse rather
no,
than.
No, not that. I'm just saying that, you know, I mean, this is a nice analogy, you know, idea about, you know, what is supposedly happening. I guess I just see, you know, reality as having other things, you know, factors there that are, you know, the social structure, the political economy is such that if you still have people who are in control of, you know, policy that are driving this disparity in wealth and disenfranchising more and more people, you know, it's those creative people that are empathic and generous need to be, I guess, in power, and I don't see that as the way things have been going.
I guess that's a fair point. Hopefully, you look at it in political terms. I mean, in the in this book, A Whole New Mind, I talk about the six abilities that matter most in the world of work, and design, story, symphony, empathy, play, and meaning. I've got a chapter about each of them and all kinds of tools and tips to help people surface those abilities. But if you take those six abilities, the six abilities that my research has told me are going to be the most important, it's clear that George Bush bested John Kerry on all of those abilities. It's clear that George Bush bested Al Gore on all of those abilities. And so, you know, we have other kinds of problems. The systemic problem that you're identifying has all kinds of solutions. One of them might be universal health insurance, but I'm not sure that's a left brain or right brain thing. I just think it's a fundamental policy question.
Well, I guess that goes to the point I'm trying to make is that there's a lot more to consider here, and I mean, if George Bush is an example of the kind of person who's going to help us get ahead, I guess I don't buy that.
Okay. Thank you. Fair enough.
All right. Well, let's go on to another caller. Just really quickly, though, before I do that, I will introduce again the guest for people who perhaps have just tuned in. We're talking this morning with Daniel Pink. He is a contributing editor at Wired, has also contributed articles on business and technology to publications including The New York Times, Harvard Business Review, and Fast Company. His last real job, as he describes it on his official website, was as a speechwriter in the White House. He served from 1995 until 1997 as chief speechwriter to Vice President Al Gore. He's also worked as an aide to the U.S. Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, and an independent an economic policy staffer in the U.S. Senate. And his book, if you're interested in reading it, is A Whole New Mind, the subtitle Why Right-Brainers Will Rule the Future, and it's published by Riverhead Books. And we have another caller here who is ready to go. This one in Urbana on line two. Hello.
Oh, hi. How
yes.
are you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I like to consider myself a right-brainer as a creative person in the sense that I've held three U.S. patents, and I've been in the advertising business for years, but it's real interesting to see how you when you sort of try to delineate this by saying, well, you're the right brain rulers. But in what I learned through my creativity process was that the left brainers run everything; they have all the money. So you have to learn how to sort of play their game. And as you were saying earlier about how you're not delineating or demarcating these, it's like you're either one or the other. It's really a synthesis of both of these, and that's a really important point. But I'd like to move to a little bit farther, and we're talking about how the advancements of these modern societies, and technologically and then socially. But where does the environment fit into this? And I know since you work for Al Gore, he's very much into the environmental future, where the Republicans, using the Bush administration as an example, don't seem to have any, you know, care or worries about it at all. And I'm just wondering what are your thoughts on the fact that, you know, global warming, the obvious one, but, you know, depletion of resources and China coming online and things like that, where you have this more consumption mm-hmm. versus where are we going to fit all of these? And I think creative processes, right-brain people will maybe can solve these, but I don't know. I just want to know if you would like to comment on that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think on your first point, I think it's very well taken. I mean, when I go to talk to a number of MFA and art and design students tomorrow at the University of Illinois, I mean, one of the most important messages that I'll convey to them is that they must become numerate. They must be able to understand numbers because that's a language of business. And if they have any hope of persuading people, they have to be able to speak that fundamental language. As to the second part regarding the environment, it's actually a very interesting question. I mean, in some ways, this abundance that I'm talking about, which is helping tilt the scales, is built in some fashion on the consumption of oil. And that is ultimately unsustainable. I agree with you on that. I think one of the most interesting developments in design, which I write about a bit in the book, is the move toward sustainable design, fashioning whether it's clothing or homes or other kinds of dwellings or industrial products or just about anything that is cradle to grave, that is doesn't create any net waste, that is made from recycled or refashioned materials. I think that one of the great entrepreneurial opportunities of our time, and you see it now in the venture capital dollars flowing in this direction, is alternative energy. And you know that the right brain ability to invent and come up with new sources of fuel is, I think, both good for the planet and an enormous business opportunity. So I actually share a lot of those concerns about the state of the environment, but ultimately I'm very optimistic about human ingenuity, and I think that human ingenuity can get us around a lot of these problems. And also, I think also the culture has changed a little bit. I mean, it used to be that global warming was more of the concern about it was more of an outlier. Now I think it's gone reasonably mainstream. I mean, look at the cover of Time magazine this week. Time magazine, not exactly a radical publication. Time magazine has a whole long cover story about global warming. You're starting to see some movies about it as well. So I think that the consciousness is changing, and I think that when the consciousness changes, then that in some fashion liberates the creativity of a lot of people to solve some of these problems.
Well, again, other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455 here for Champaign-Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. To what extent do you think, and again, going, we go back to the idea that partly what we're talking about here is metaphor when we talk about these different styles mm-hmm. of thinking. But to what extent do you think that the kind of people that you're talking about are born that way, and to what extent that has to do with life experiences? And specifically, I'm thinking about the kind of experiences that people have in school.
I think that people might be born with a slight inclination one way or the other. But I also think that everybody has the potential to master these sorts of right brain abilities, the abilities of design and storytelling and what I call symphony and empathy. We all have innate predilections, either strongly in favor of them or against them, but I think that these are abilities that we all can develop. I mean, essentially, a good analogy is to think about literacy and numeracy. We tend to believe that everybody can become literate and numerate. Just about everybody can become literate and numerate. Now, to say that everybody can read and write reasonably well, we can get everybody to read and write reasonably well, or get them to become numerate, doesn't mean that everybody is going to become Toni Morrison, and doesn't mean everybody is going to become Stephen Hawking. And I think it's the same thing with these, that we can get people up to speed on a lot of these abilities. It doesn't mean that everybody is going to be a Karen Rashid designer or Steve Jobs entrepreneur, but I think all of us can become adept at these things. Now, your point about schools is actually very interesting, because I think in many ways you can make a very strong argument that our schools are moving in precisely the opposite direction, that there's this mania for routines and right answers, very left-brain approach. Schools are obsessed with routines and right answers, and increasingly people's jobs, people's livelihoods, routines and right answers don't really matter all that much. What matters more is the ability to deal with novelty and nuance. And so our schools, with their mania over standardized testing, with cutting art programs, cutting drama programs, cutting music programs, I think in many ways are fighting the last war. And I think that's one area that I'm generally optimistic about all these things. Not because I'm Pollyanna-ish, because I'm actually a very analytical guy. And if you look back at the predictions that people have made about the future, the optimists actually tend to be much more accurate than the pessimists. But the one area where I am pessimistic is the state of our schools. I think that many of them are moving in precisely the wrong direction.
Well, that's interesting, because that's exactly what I would have expected you to say, and that you would be with those people who would. And I think there has been a lot of concern voiced recently about the implications of the beating on this accountability drum, and mm-hmm. the fact that it gets us to things like high stakes testing. It gets us to things like recent stories about how so much concentration is put on basically math and reading, and doing that so that you can pass the tests, and a lot of that has to do with No Child Left Behind, that we're cutting out a lot of other sorts of things. And part of the things we might be cutting out might be things like art and music, might even be things like history.
History, even science.
Yeah.
Right. I think that it's very dangerous. I think it's very much fighting the last war. And just because something can be measured, and it's somewhat easier to measure those kinds of abilities, but just because something can be measured doesn't mean that it ought to be measured or ought to be the only thing that's measured. So I think that it's actually fairly dangerous. The idea that if we focus exclusively on math and reading, obviously they're important. But math and reading out of any kind of context doesn't make any sense, because when you or I or anybody in our adult lives, in our lives as citizens, our lives as workers, we don't just do math or just read. It's in some kind of context. And you read in order to gain some understanding. You read to see if someone is telling you the truth. You read to gain a broader insight into the world. Numeracy is just another form of literacy. And so we do math in order to understand the world, explain the world. And so these sorts of narrow technical skills out of any context, it's great for passing a test. It's almost useless for other realms.
Let's talk with another caller. This is someone in Urbana, and it's line one.
Hello. Yeah.
Yes, hello.
Yeah, hi. I have three small questions. First is, how is your analysis or prediction different from your former boss's Robert Rice argument made sometime in the 90s that the future belonged to the symbolic analysts? The second question is, how does globalization or sensitivity for cultural difference fit into this kind of person that you think will be the future ideal employee? And third, it's another aspect of globalization. I'm wondering if you're a little naive about the inability of these kinds of jobs being outsourced. After all, if you look at the legal profession, more and more of the job, like legal research that used to be done by American lawyers, are now outsourced to India. And actually, I'm wondering if that might be a good thing, because it's not until the intellectuals themselves find themselves outsourced that they will finally stand up for those people who will never be able to fill those jobs that you think will represent the future. Thank you very much.
Okay, so three questions. Let me take them in order. On the Robert Reich, who, again, full disclosure, is my former boss, he wrote a book in the early 1990s called The Work of Nations, where he said that the key figure in the economy was what he called symbolic analysts, or sort of a close cousin to what Peter Drucker called knowledge workers. And what I'm arguing is that some of those knowledge workers, some of those symbolic analysts, the ones who remain are going to be the ones who can do things that you can't do cheaper overseas and can't get done faster by computer. And a lot of the folks in that category, the symbolic analysts and the knowledge workers, certain kinds of financial analysts, certain kinds of accountants, that's no longer true. And those folks are going to have to develop a set of capacities, mostly these right-brain abilities, artistry, empathy, big-picture thinking, that will allow them to survive and thrive. We're still going to have accountants in this country. We're still going to have lawyers in this country, but they're going to be doing different things. They're going to be doing things that aren't routine, that are hard to outsource and hard to automate. So in some ways, this analysis that I'm making is in some small way the next iteration of Reich's symbolic analyst point. On the globalization, first part about the globalization, the caller asked about what role, paraphrasing here, what role multiculturalism and the ability to move across boundaries plays. And I actually think that it is enormously important. In a chapter on symphony, which is the ability to, it's an ability that I talk about, seeing patterns, seeing the big picture, combining disparate things into something the world didn't know it was missing, that is a key ability. So this kind of world, there's a premium on people who can move smoothly across boundaries, who are multidisciplinary, who are multilingual, who are multifaceted. And so I think that this world of globalization advantages people who aren't narrow specialists, but who have that multiple perspective, whether it's linguistic, whether it's cultural, whether it's ethnic, whether it's national. I think there's a premium on people like that, multifaceted, what I call boundary crossers. The third point is I actually write about legal work being outsourced, because certain kinds of routine legal work can be outsourced. You see it now. There's a very interesting company, Indian company called Pangea, Pangea 3, I think is the name, that does certain kinds of routine legal outsourcing. And I actually think that's, I mean, probably get all kinds of hate mail from lawyers, but I actually think that's perfectly fine. I think it's good. If someone can get the same sort of services at a cheaper price, I think that's good for consumers. And if somebody, and if a lawyer loses his or her work or has to evolve to a different kind of work, well, I mean, to my mind, that's how economies operate. That's how we get broader prosperity. That's how we liberate people to do more interesting work. But yes, I think the point that the caller is making is actually very astute politically, and that one of the reasons we have a backlash to outsourcing now is because it isn't simply call centers, it isn't simply manufacturing work, but it's beginning to be some of these white-collar professionals. And I think there's a certain level of hypocrisy in the white-collar professionals who've always gloried in globalization when it finally hits them to say, oh, wait a second, this globalization thing maybe it's not so great after all.
All right, let's go to Champaign for someone else. This is line two. Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I thought I was told line one, so I was taken back.
Oh, no, yeah, go ahead. We got you.
Yeah, what are your, in other words, what are the implications using your scenario for the future for the political environment? I don't see a lot of, you know, generally among politicians, I don't see a lot of empathy at this point.
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of the political establishment embracing this, I think the political establishment is behind. I mean, we talked about it in terms of schools, which are part of the government apparatus, and I don't think that schools have really, at least sort of public elementary and secondary schools have really embraced this. I don't think they move particularly quickly. I think if you look at if you look at higher education, then you see actually a lot of difference. You see a place like Georgia Tech requiring incoming students to be able to play an instrument. You see MFA programs like the one they have at the University of Illinois, MFA programs teaming up with MBA programs to provide a more whole-minded kind of curriculum for business graduates. You see this very much in play in entrepreneurial companies and even in some of the big companies, which both of which can move faster than government. I mean, you have General Motors, obviously has some very, very difficult times right now. General Motors is hiring sculptors. Procter & Gamble has got rid of a lot of its engineers. Procter & Gamble is looking for, has something like 60 openings right now in Cincinnati for designers. You see it in a company like VistaCare, which is a publicly held company in the hospice care business, which is very high touch, very difficult to outsource, very difficult to automate. You see it in the success of aesthetics-based companies like Target, which is competing with Walmart, not on the left-brain dimension of price, but on the right-brain dimension of look and feel and design and aesthetics. You see it in the incredible success of Apple and the iPod. The iPod is in many ways a design triumph. It's partly an engineering triumph, but it's mostly a design triumph because it looks cool. It's easy, and the iTunes is easy to use. And so, in organizations, institutions that can move faster than government, you see this already taking hold. Now, when politicians or government get the message, I'm not sure. I think in many ways they're, as I've said before, they're fighting the last war. Their legislators are imposing these unbelievably rigid standards on schools. I think that teachers and even principals know better. And teachers and even principals know that their job, their responsibility is to give kids a very whole-minded education. As a result, they're forced to smuggle in a lot of these things under these unbelievably rigid standards and under the shadow of this mania over standardized testing.
So you would say they're the last to get on board at this point?
Yeah, I think so. But I don't think that's necessarily anything that all that new. And the other thing is that the established interest groups, which is basically who politicians respond to, are basically established interest groups are essentially trying to maintain the status quo. So there's an institutionalization in politics of the status quo because the people, the organizations, the interest groups that have the most to lose are the ones that make the greatest campaign donations and therefore make the default position of politics some form of stasis.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. Our guest here in this part of Focus 580 is Daniel Pink. His book is A Whole New Mind, Why Right-Brainers Will Rule the Future. It's out in paperback by Riverhead Books. It has sold very well, been very popular. In fact, I think it's in its eighth North American printing. He's a contributing editor at Wired. As he mentioned, he was at one point an aide to the Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich. That was in the Clinton administration. He also was a chief speechwriter, in fact, for Vice President Al Gore between 1995 and 1997. And questions, comments are certainly welcome. Just to go back to, I'm interested in whether you, to what extent you think that somehow success, if getting elected to office is success, for political for political leaders, has something to do with embodying these qualities. And I guess I'm thinking about your comments about John Kerry and George Bush. And certainly I think that it is true, at least part of the conventional explanation for why Mr. Kerry wasn't more successful is that people couldn't relate to him. He seemed a little cold and a little cerebral, and he couldn't tell a simple story to save his life. And that's something that actually President Bush is, and then Kennedy Bush, was pretty good at. Now, he may not, in fact, genuinely embody all these qualities, but it seems like you can actually see some of them in the kinds of things that he says. Is that, do you think, that practicing working on some of these characteristics, if you were running for office, would help?
Yes, I do. I mean, again, it's important. It's important to, again, showing my left brain tendencies here. I think it's important to look at this sort of question analytically, and not. I mean, caller sentiment down in Champaign-Urbana is running pretty significantly against President Bush. But let's look at it analytically, and maybe you can disagree with his policies, but look at the set of abilities that he is deploying. I think that if you asked anybody, whatever their persuasion, who is a more empathic person, Kerry or Bush, I think that people would say Bush. I think who is a better ability to get out of the maw of pure facts and only facts and put facts in context and deliver them with emotional impact by telling a story to explain your point of view. I think that Bush is good on that. One of the things that I talk about quite a bit is meaning, the capacity to explain a cause larger than oneself. And I think that Bush clearly was better at that than Kerry. People might disagree with the transcendent purpose that he was advocating, but it was a transcendent purpose. I don't think that people had any sense of what Kerry was going to do his first day or his first year in office. It was he basically just wanted to be president, and he didn't want George Bush to be president, which is understandable, I can say. But George Bush had a transcendent mission. I mean, remaking the Middle East, bringing democracy to the Middle East. We can disagree over the goal, we can disagree over the means, but I don't think we can disagree that that's some kind of broader purpose. And so I think that these abilities are very, very useful. Very useful in politics. I think they've always been useful in politics. I think that these abilities are actually becoming much more useful in an array of professions where these sorts of skills have often been overlooked and undervalued.
Mm-hmm. I guess, in a sense, this is kind of a side issue, but it brings to mind the one major criticism of President Bush is that he seems to be a man who would not even admit to the possibility of ever having been wrong about anything. And that goes to the notion that in politics it's sometimes a very difficult and very costly thing to stand up and say, this is what I thought last month, I was wrong and I've changed my mind. People they seem to identify with people who have this air of certainty, and that's not necessarily a good thing.
No, it's not. I mean, I don't think that any of these abilities are the sort of give a license for delusion, and I don't think they excuse you from introspection and analyzing the facts at all. I think that, I mean, David, the point you're making is in some ways about the political culture, where if your opinions change over time, if you are a thinking person and you get new data or new experiences, and what you believed yesterday is not quite the same as what you believe today. In politics, that's called flip-flopping, and your opponents will clobber you for it. Now, that's something that human beings do all the time, and so I think it's an unfortunate one of the many unfortunate aspects of the coarsening of political culture. Now, on Bush himself, I mean, I think one can make a fairly good criticism about his inadequate left brain abilities, his inadequate abilities to actually look at the facts and look at the data and look, I think it's true on science policy. I think it's true on environmental policy. I think it might even be partly true on certain kinds of fiscal policy. If you just look at the federal budget, I mean, it's dangerously out of whack, and but not only it's deficit, but also it's budget priorities, and there's no acknowledgement of that by the president.
Let's talk with some other folks here. Another Champaign caller, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Two things, one a question, one a comment. One, I was going to become a speechwriter. I actually think that's interesting, and I'm disagreeing your point about politics being behind. It seems that certainly the right wing has been ahead of the curve as far as the right brain ability. It's been a very subliminal game for 25 years at least, and so I'm just disagreeing with your earlier statement, but agreeing with a lot of the things that you just said. And speech writing is a key thing, so I kind of wonder if you could talk about, you know, how that worked for you. Anyway.
Sure. Let me take your first point. Again, I think it's very important to be analytical about this. And I think that the Republicans and the right actually had big ideas. I think that a lot of those big ideas some of them are unraveling. But I think Republicans had a big idea. They had a transcendent view of things. They had a public philosophy in a way that the Democrats did not. And so to say that their success is somehow subliminal, that it's some kind of insidious tricks, I just think it's wrong. Republicans, I think, in many, many ways, in the right, in bigger ways, in many fashion, are out-argued the Democrats and the left. Now, that being said, as for being a speechwriter, you know what? I mean, generally, I don't think there is any kind of path. What I did is I graduated from law school. I never practiced law a day in my life. I left law school and started working on political campaigns for Democratic candidates. Basically, all of the campaigns that I worked on lost. So it seemed like my future was not bright as a political operative, but it turned out that I was actually a pretty fast typist and an okay writer and ended up falling into that. And so for those of you, especially students out there who are interested in doing that, I mean, you can take any – if you can write and any kind of staff job in politics, if you can write, you're going to be in great shape. And if things get ugly for you, you can then migrate to become a speechwriter.
Well, at that, I think we'll finish up with one more mention that our guest, Daniel Pink, will be on the campus of the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign tomorrow. He's going to give a talk sponsored by the School of Art and Design, 4:30 tomorrow afternoon in room 100 of Gregory Hall on the campus. So if you'd like to hear more from him, you can stop by. And also, if you'd like to read the book, it's titled A Whole New Mind, Why Right-Brainers Will Rule the Future, published in paperback by Riverhead Books. And Mr. Pink, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me on the program. I've enjoyed it.
Today's program is made possible by support from Victorian House at 408 East Main in downtown Mahomet. Victorian House specializes in unique glass art, jewelry, and gifts. Victorian House also offers classes in bead making and in stained glass on the web at victorianhouse.biz. Programming here is also made possible by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. And that's it for us, but we want you to stay tuned because there's much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we will